Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 24 of Game On with Cody and John.
On this episode's big deal,
conversations.
It's convention season. We'll give you tips and tricks to navigate your favorite game convention.
And on this episode's buy, try, or deny,
wealth of nations.
Will it be a booming economy or a horrible recession?
All this and much more on Game On with Cody and John.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, role-playing games. Coming to you from beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana.
It's good to be back.
It is good to be back. We've had a week off, an additional week off, for some vacation time. We've done lots of great stuff, including Cody's bachelor party.
It was fun.
Went down to Cincinnati to watch a Reds game. I'm now a hat-carrying member of the Reds faithful.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I decided to go ahead and be a Cincinnati Reds fan.
And despite their best efforts, they actually won.
They did. So. They did. Nice two-run home run by Mr. Johnny Gomes.
I'm ready to buy his jersey.
Yep. But we're back in the podcasting studio here at the Game On Studios to bring you the best in gaming information. And we're going to be talking this episode about game conventions. It's con season.
Indeed, when a young man's thoughts turn to conventions.
Indeed. And so we're going to be talking about all the great tips and tricks for how to navigate convention season. And we got Gen Con coming up in just a few weeks. We just got back from Origins. There's also some other ones that go on all around the country. And we're just going to, for those of you who have never been before, we might be able to give you some information on how to best navigate those conventions.
Absolutely. And we've got a great buy, try, or deny. Speaking of Origins, one of the Origins Awards nominees for Best Game, Wealth of Nations.
Yeah, a great economics game from Table Star Games. And we'll be talking about that one, giving you a whole full review. We've also got a couple of surprises for you, so stay tuned.
Yeah, we've got a full show, but as always, we will kick it off with the Game On Inbox right
now.
The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it.
Well, it's time again for the Game On Inbox, the best in gaming news and information. We're going to start off by talking about some news regarding Game On with Cody and John, and that is the addition of a corporate sponsor.
Ooh.
We have officially sold out to the man.
That's right.
And so we want to tell you about our sponsor.
The man,
known as it's Myriad Games, which is a great, friendly, professional game store in Salem, New Hampshire, which is nowhere near where we live.
Absolutely.
But I've seen pictures of the store online, and it looks really awesome.
Yes.
I wish that it was in our town.
Next time I go to Salem, New Hampshire, I'm definitely stopping by.
Could you pick something up for me?
Sure.
Okay. but we just want to encourage you to check out myriadgames.com. We've kind of built a good relationship with Dan from Myriad Games. He's a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. They have some podcasts called Myriad Games Presentations that you can check out at pulpgamer.com and also through iTunes and all those sort of normal podcast venues there. But they're very much committed at Myriad Games to promoting the friendly professional game store. Now, you've heard the term friendly local gaming store before, but they're really wanting to key in on this idea of these game stores being professional. Because I don't know about you, but I've been to some game stores that are...
Most of the ones around here aren't very professional.
Not very professional, yeah. And so Dan is a very professional guy, quite the businessman, and just loves gaming too. And so you're going to hear pretty much every episode from now for a little while some information about Myriad Games, because we think it's just a great store, and hey, they're sponsoring us, so of course we're going to talk about them. So listen to this and find out a little bit more about Myriad Games.
Greetings from Myriad Games, your friendly professional game store. Myriad Games offers a wide variety of family fun for everyone. We don't just sell pieces of cardboard and plastic, we sell fun. We're proud to have the opportunity to serve as your friendly professional game store, whether locally here in New England or anywhere around the world through MyriadGames.com. We also offer a Myriad Gamer membership for our regular customers. We're proud to present Myriad Games presentations, available through iTunes and the show links at MyriadGames.com. Be sure to leave us a review on iTunes to receive your complimentary pair of Myriad dice and to be entered in drawings for free Myriad gear and $100 of Myriad money. Your feedback is very important to us. Please email us through myriadgames.com with your comments, questions, suggestions, abuse, and general ridicule. For more about a myriad of games, visit your friendly professional game store and be sure to visit us online at myriadgames.com. Myriad Games. So many games, so little time. So start playing.
All right, well, now that we've finished selling out to the man for this episode, we'll move on to games we've been playing.
So I think something we need to talk about before we get into that there is a champion in our midst. And it's not me, for once.
I'm blushing right now.
Blushing. Mr. John Richard, the winner of the Spiel's 12th Annual Formula Day Tournament, and that's a golf clap.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you very much.
Well done.
It was a very exciting tournament. For those of you who don't know, Dave Coulson and Stephen Conway, who do the Spiel podcast, do a annual Formula Day tournament. It is a really well-run affair, and they even have some interesting ways that they do time trials. This year's time trial for the Formula Day tournament was a combination game of Crokinole and soccer. They called Kickinole. And it was basically they set up – Stephen made a Crokinole board in his yard – and you had to use kickballs to kick and try to get the best score, and it was a timed thing too. It was very interesting. But there was 20 people there. Last year, it was the first year I had been invited to come to this tournament, and I came in dead last, which
nicely
I think
done.
Was like 17th or 18th, something like that. This year, I was able to do what few haven't, which is going from worst to first, and came away with the victory. So last year, I left with the beat-up gold spray-painted hubcap with a turtle on it. This year, I came home with the jeweled steering wheel.
And it is a beaut, so if you want to lose at Formula D, John is your man. Now, what other games have you been playing?
Well, I've also been playing a lot of stuff while I was on vacation with my family. I got to go to Virginia Beach and visit some of my friends and family there, and so brought a big bag of games with me. One of the games that I played a couple of games of is something that I picked up at Origins, and that is Dice Town by Asmodee Editions, and designed by Ludovic Malblanc and Bruno Cathala.
Of course.
Yes. This is a great dice, sort of a poker dice game, where you're trying to build your best poker hand so that you can get some benefits that are on the board. It's got the theme of sort of the Old West. And if it was just a purely poker game, that would be not very exciting, I don't think, because I don't know, just trying to build the best poker hand, that's a little bit limiting. But in this case, you also can get benefits for having the most nines, the most tens. And it uses these special dice where it has a 9, 10, jack, queen, king, and ace on the die. So it doesn't really matter what suit they are. And so you're trying to build these combinations, and based upon that, you're going to get cards that might be worth points. You might get, there's a sheriff role that'll help to break ties and other things like that. So a lot of really cool mechanics in that one. I would highly recommend picking that one up. If we had time, I would want to do a full review of this game, but I may actually end up doing a review on Board Game Geek for that one. It's a really, really great game, so pick that one up if you get the chance. Also played some Dominion Intrigue. We talked about that one in the last episode, the hot item from Origins.
The new hotness.
That's right. Got to play a two-player game of that, and that one's a lot of fun. I think that I need to get some more plays in on that. Would you play that with me sometime?
Yeah. I love that game.
Played some Unspeakable Words. That's a fun word game. Also, some Yahtzee Free-for-All. And, gosh, it's actually been a lot of gaming lately.
Yeah.
We mentioned before the game Ubongo, which is a simultaneous puzzle-solving game for 2 to 4 players, where you're sort of using these Tetris pieces to put together these little puzzles, and you're timed and that kind of stuff. Z-Man Games is the publisher in America of Ubongo, and there's also other versions of that. There's Ubongo Extreme, which instead of the pieces being sort of square-based, they're hex-based. So that makes it a lot more complicated.
That would end my life.
And then there's also a version called Ubongo the Duel, or Ubongo Duel, which is a two-player version, which is a lot more straightforward than the original Ubongo, where you basically are doing the same puzzle simultaneously. In regular Ubongo, you're not necessarily doing the same puzzle, but it's something of, you know, similar complexity. In this case, you have the same pieces, same puzzle, you've got your own board, and it's just a race to see who gets done with theirs first, and the first person to get 5 puzzles is the winner. A lot of fun. It's retails for, I think, maybe $20, and my wife and I love playing this one, so that's a really good one you might want to check out. And also, the last game I'll mention is the game Time Streams, which is one we just recently got a copy of from Bucephalus Games. and thanks very much for that copy. And had a chance to play that with my father-in-law, and it's sort of a CCG-esque sort of game, but it's got there's no collectible aspect to it. You get two decks in a box, and you can play a full game with that. But I think they may expand it as time goes on. But I won't talk about that one right now. What I actually did was, after playing it, I wrote a full review for that. It's my first written game review that I've published on GameOnPodcast.com, as well as on BoardGameGeek.com. So if you go and check it out at either of those places, you can read what I thought about Time Streams. But I'll give you a hint. It's a pretty good little game. All right, well, Cody, enough about me gabbing. What have you been playing lately?
Well, I played some games as well while I was traveling. I tried out Who Would Win, which is a little game we discovered at Origins, and it's basically a party game, but with the idea where it'll take two random characters or historical figures, like Martha Stewart versus Darth Vader, and then it has a random contest, like in a game of chicken, in a debate, in a mud wrestling match, et cetera, et cetera. And the everyone playing divides into two teams, and there's usually a judge. And you go back and forth, and you're trying to convince the judge who would win. And when you do this, you get some kind of crazy arguments going on. But it's a fun game. It was a nice light one. We played that. We played Are You the Traitor, which we reviewed last time. And I have to say, the more I play it, kind of the less I like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm starting to kind of see. I've seen some of the negative reviews around the horn, and it's I'm starting to see it, because the first game we played, it was literally, I explained the rules, we handed out the cards, and I made sure everyone knew what was going on, and there was just kind of silence. Like, are you the traitor? You know, it didn't have that structure that Werewolf had, and it wasn't any of the player's fault by any means. It's just kind of that unstructured conversation was very unsettling, and no one really got into the spirit of the game, so that was kind of a downer. We played the Game On Classic Ink and Gold. Of course.
That's a great one.
And I got creamed, as I usually do in it. But I kept our tradition alive. We shout ink and gold whenever we reveal. If we're going in, staying out.
And, you know, I think that's unique to us. I don't know of any other people that are doing that regularly. No. So we can spread that. For you folks at home that are that have ink and gold, whenever you play the game, when it's time to turn your card over, you say 1, 2, 3...
Ink and gold
makes the game a ton more fun. Seriously,
and you get people looking over at you, kind of strangely.
And if you're playing this at a convention, you can really probably draw some people in. Oh, yeah. What are these people yelling for?
But that was a fun one. And the last one we tried was a new game from Buffalo Games called Ruin. And I could go into that, but I think it's time we had a.
It's time for a Game On bonus review.
Bonus review.
Bonus review.
Bonus review.
A bonus review. I don't know why I was interrupted there by the audio.
that was very strange. I don't know where that came from.
Indeed. Well, I'm going to give you the skinny on Ruin.
I'm excited about this. This is
going to be bad.
I had to think back to our previous episodes. Have you ever given the full rules rundown in a game?
No, and I'm not going to give you the full rules rundown. I'll give you the general.
The Cody Jones version.
The Cody Jones version.
All right, yeah. Well, go for it, man.
All right. Ruin is basically a roll and move game, kind of in the same vein as Sorry. And it's for 1 to 4 players, if you wanted to play it solo for whatever reason.
That might not be any fun, but...
and the idea is you're all explorers trying to get to the heart of this ancient ruin. And you have two explorers, or two dudes, as I call them. The idea is to get both of your dudes around the entire board and into the safe zone. The problem is, it's not just a standard roll and move game with a set board. The board is actually made up of cards, and people can play cards to change the path, maybe put you at a dead end, or even drop you in a pit. And you'll counteract this by, there'll be idols on the board of colors that kind of act as, I call them safe points. So say you fall down a pit, you go to your nearest idol. If it's one square away, that's not so bad. If it's halfway across the board, that's a lot worse.
Right.
But play will continue. It's a very light game where you'll roll a die, and sometimes you'll get a number that will allow you to change a card, and sometimes you'll get just a straight number to where you just move and pass the die. So it's a very light game. I think it would be great for kids. I want to say the board says 10 and up. I think you could go even less. I think you go 8 and up. Definitely.
It's a light game. It does not have a light die.
No, the die is this massive honking
D20. That's right.
That could kill a man.
I think I almost broke Cody's table when I decided to do a vigorous roll.
But the game continues like that, and the gist of the game basically is moving along the path and changing the path, not only to kind of screw your opponents, but also to give you the straightest path and the quickest way to the center. So it's a very light game. I really liked it, actually. It's one that it was a nice game you don't have to think much about, but it still had some strategy, had good components to it, and I liked it. And I introduced this to John as well as Single L, and what did you think?
Yeah, I think it's a really fun game. And like you said, it's real light. And I think I noticed as we were playing the game that we were playing it and we were rolling and moving and playing the cards and doing the little minor strategy that exists in the game. But we were also talking and laughing, and we weren't even necessarily really paying that close attention to the game. And some might see that as a negative thing, but for that particular setting where we were just having fun, real light, didn't want anything that was too deep, it was perfect for that. Yeah. I love the components in this game because the board itself, it's just kind of a normal board, but there's this plastic overlay that sits over top of it, and that's what your cards are going to slide underneath so that your pieces actually will stay where they are as you're manipulating what's underneath them. But there's also, as you go into the middle there, it almost looks like this sort of little plastic volcano, you know, very shallow. But and so that was kind of neat. And I think for the game retails for, gosh, I think it's only like $15 or $20, something like that.
It's a good deal for what you get.
Yeah. Yep. So I really liked it. I thought it was fun.
I think I can best describe it as, if you're going to have a long game night, this is a great first game. This is kind of to get everyone around the table and into the game playing mode, but without a ton of rules to hit them over the head with.
Yep.
And it's something you can teach maybe non-gamers. I think it would be good for just general family members who may not want to play a deeper game, and it's good for kids too. So if we're doing a buy, try, or deny, which I'm going to
go for,
I have that authority, I will actually give this a buy, even though it is a little more simple than your standard game, your hobby game fare. I think it's very adaptable to any situation, and I think it's a heck of a lot of fun.
I would also give it a buy if you have a lot of non-gamers in your life that you want to play games with. If you have like a regular game group that plays heavy games and that's all you have, like you're not playing with your spouse or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your sisters, brothers, whatever, then I'm not sure if that this would really fit the bill for you, because I think it would just be too light. But like I said, if you got, you know, a lot of family events or just some non-gamers you play with, this one's perfect. So I'll give it a buy too.
Yeah, so a pair of buys. Go out and check out Ruin. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I think you did a really good job on this bonus review.
I don't think I did, but we'll try.
We'll listen back to the tape later. Uh-huh. So as we mentioned before, we just got back from Origins 2009, a great time. And if you want to hear more about it, you can check out episode 23 where we talk a whole bunch about Origins.
Spoiler, it's the last one we did.
It's the one we just did. One of the things they do every year at Origins is they give out awards, the Origins Awards.
Not just a clever name.
and these are awards that are voted on by the attendees. So when you get your badge, you get a little ballot, and there's a case there that has all the games displayed, and you can
And you're
out.
Hounded by exhibitors.
Oh, it's like lobbying.
Vote I-7. Buy 7 on your card.
Did you not get a card? Here, I got one right here for you.
I got 6.
So, you know, we have said many times before that we care very little about awards, but one award did
surprise us.
It jumped out at us a little bit, and that's the fact that the Best Role-Playing Game Award for this year at Origins was not given to D&D 4th Edition, but instead to Mouse Guard.
Indeed.
And Cody actually owns both of these games.
Heck yeah, I do.
And so, I mean, what did you think about this?
That's surprising to me in usually such a big change with D&D would almost be a shoe-in in years past.
Yeah.
But I think we've seen, as far as just their sales numbers and just fans in general, that 4th edition not even really as popular as the other editions. It's really, they lost a lot of fans with the Switch, I think.
But you like it, right? I mean, you like that game.
Yeah, for 4th edition to me, it's like, I enjoy playing it, and, you know, I'll run it, I guess. You know, it's like, I guess, if someone wants to play it, I'll run it. But it's a solid game system, and I enjoy it. But to me, there are other games, and I think the problem with a lot of people was that the earlier edition of D&D 3.5, it wasn't really broken. I mean, yeah, you could exploit it, but you could do that with any other rule system. You know, if you really knew how to tweak it and min-max it, you could do it, and you can do that with 4th as well. But as a system, it wasn't really flawed. I mean, it was a viable system, and people have been playing it and really enjoyed it. And I think that when they came out with the 3.5 revision, just a few years into 3.0.
It was just like two or three years, right?
It may have been like 3 or 4. Okay. But it was still kind of, as far as editions go.
Well, given the gap between second and third.
Right.
I'm sure that probably made a lot of, this is, and really when 3.5 came out, that's before I kind of got into gaming. So I heard that sort of ticked a lot of people off.
Yeah. But I think people were okay as long as it didn't happen again, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And then the way they kind of they released 4th edition, or, you know, said, hey, we're going to be doing this next year, a lot of people were just saying it was too soon. And the fact that they were still releasing 3.5 product for that whole year when 4th edition was in development, it kind of sent mixed signals. And a lot of people just don't like the new system because it is a kind of a radically new system. That is, it's a little more transparent as far as the game mechanics. You kind of peer behind the curtain more and you really see the crunchy bits working more.
Besides the money grab aspect of it, what do you think, having played all these editions, would be the motivation for even making 4th edition in the first place? Or was it mainly the money grab?
Well, I obviously they're a company, they want to make money. I don't fault them for that. I do think they saw maybe just some things where they wanted to simplify. I think actually the success of the MMORPG like World of Warcraft and things like that, I think they really saw a niche there that they thought they could fill in the tabletop market. And, sure, 4th edition is greatly influenced by MMORPGs. You'd have to be kind of blind not to see that. It's just
in what way? Just what about MMORPGs has provided that influence?
Well, it's everything is more.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be like pinning you down. I don't even really know though. So.
We don't get to talk about RPGs much.
I know.
So that's nice.
Enlighten me.
It's everything is kind of focused almost to a combat end. Like, no longer are spells and such thought of in durations of feet. It's all squares. Like, this will affect 4 squares instead of 25 feet, for instance.
Oh, okay.
Things of that nature.
So there's no way to abstract that out. You almost have to have the board with the miniatures there.
You could play with 3.5 without miniatures, and you could do it. It may be a little difficult, but it wasn't unheard of.
Right.
4th edition, you have to have a battle mat. You have to have miniatures. And it's much more of a tactical game. They've emphasized the kind of the team aspect and that everyone has a role. Like, I'm the tank, I'm the damage dealer, I'm the controller, you know. Things that everyone was kind of shoehorned into roles. Like I said, they just went from a gritty simulation to something that was more over the top. And the mechanics are a lot easier to see kind of behind the curtain. So some people dig it, some people don't. It is a lot easier to run and play, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not for everyone, and I think it was 4th edition was released, I think, probably a little too soon after 3.5, and people just kind of threw their hands up and said, fine.
Now, you own Mouse Guard. You haven't had a chance to play it yet, but after reading through it, what do you think? Do you think it was a worthy winner of the
definitely.
Of the award?
It uses the Burning Wheel role-playing system, which has been, it's kind of this, it is the most indie of the indie RPGs. It's from what I've seen, it's just a very unique, it's story-first. Even the combat in that, it's almost the reverse. Even the combat is very vocally driven, and you make arguments and things of that nature. Mm. Mouse Guard's a simplified version of that because the main complaint with Burning Wheel is it's almost too complex and just too kind of convoluted to follow.
Well, that's not marketable.
No. But Mouse Guard really slims that down and gives you a workable system. And I think we're just seeing a shift in RPGs in general. I think D&D 3.0 and 3.5 was the peak of the, we're going to make this a simulation, we're going to make this, you know, as realistic as possible. Now we're kind of going back to almost a story-first, rules-light kind of system, and I think Mouse Guard winning this award over 4th edition is a good harbinger of that.
All right, well, that's that kind of wraps up gaming news. That's news/discussion, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting about Mouse Guard. So maybe we'll have to put together a game of that.
I'd like to.
Check it out. Talk about it on the show. All right, well, one of the games that I got to play while I was on vacation that I didn't mention earlier is a new word game from Out of the Box Publishing. And we talked to Leo Osterhaus at Out of the Box at Origins and picked up this game called Word on the Street. And so I had an opportunity to take that one into work. And so that means it's time for another edition of The Lunch Table.
The Lunch Table. When you're on the job, what better way to spend your lunch hour than playing games with good friends? Let's see what's on the lunch menu this week.
So Word on the Street is from Out of the Box Publishing. It was released in 2009. Actually, it was released right at Origins. They said it came straight from the boat from China to Origins. And it's for 2 to a lot of players, probably can accommodate maybe up to 10 or more, because it's a team game, so you're going to create two teams. If you have two players, it's a team of one each on either side.
Nicely done.
Thank you. And it's a word game, and it's not just a clever title. It's called Word on the Street because the board itself is a street. And it's a grid, I guess, and then it has this sort of boulevard down the middle. And on this boulevard are different letter tiles. And they're these big, nice, chunky, plasticky, clinky tiles, almost kind of ceramic-like, I guess. And they have all of the letters of the alphabet except no vowels, and they've also removed the letters J, Z, X, and Q. Because there's not, I guess, a whole lot of words that have those in them, so it would make the game a little bit more difficult. So all of those letters are going to start right in the middle of this street. And then on either side of this boulevard where the tiles are, there are two spaces, and then you'll be off the board. The idea is it's kind of a tug-of-war game almost, where you're going to be trying to pull letters towards your side of the street and then get them off the board. So it would take three spaces to get a letter from the middle off the board. Now, how are you going to get these letters off the board? Well, you get a deck of cards that have all of these clues on them, and they're double-sided. There's a green side that's easier and a blue side that's more difficult, and it would be things like something that comes in a bottle. And what you're going to do in your turn is draw one of these cards, read that clue, and then your team is going to have to come up with a word that fits that clue. And so something that comes in the bottle could be wine, or, you know, you want to pick the biggest word you can. And what you're going to do then is, as you spell the word, you're going to move the letters one step closer to your side of the board. Once a letter comes all the way off the board, it can't be moved again. You're pretty much captured by your team. But until that point, it can be moved back. So let's say that you did use the word wine, which would be W-I-N-E. There's no I or E in wine, and so you would move the W and move the N one space towards you. It just kind of goes back and forth. There's a sand timer, and that makes it a little bit more interesting in that you turn that sand timer over as soon as you get the clue, and you have that much time to decide what word you're going to do and to move all of your tiles. And so, you know, you can sit there and sort of go back and forth with several words, but you're kind of on a time crunch to get that thing done. And then the goal is to capture 8 letters. So once you get 8 letters to your side, you are the winner. And that's as straightforward as it is. It's a real easy game, and one that I really enjoyed playing with the folks at work. So let's go to the lunch table and see what they had to say. All right, so we just finished playing Word on the Street. Got a group of 5 folks in this time. We have all of which you have heard before. Jenny, Karen. Single L, and David, you guys need to all work on your own theme songs for next time. So we played Word on the Street by Out of the Box Games. It's a team game for 2 to 8 players, and I've already given you guys all the description of the rules. So what did you guys think of the game? Give me some opinions here.
Good party game.
Good party game.
Fun party game, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. The ladies are quiet because they lost.
That was a good game.
It was okay. A good game.
Played pretty quickly, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like a lot of the letters kind of get ganged up on initially, and then some of the, like the Y and the W and the V all seem to kind of hang at the end. But
so really, if you wanted to win faster, if you went for the Y, the V, and the W ahead of time, that might help.
There you go.
Yeah. That's kind of one of my concerns is, will all the games come down to trying to figure out words to start with W and Y? Now, they've taken out like the J and the Z and the Q, which all I think would, you know, streamline things a little bit. But we played in what, it took about 20 minutes, I guess, to get through the whole game?
Yeah.
Thereabouts, yeah.
It's on par with the other word games. What's the one with the little creatures that you're trying to, they're stealing your mind?
Oh, Unspeakable Words.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah. I like that one.
Lloyd liked this game so much, he's thinking about another one.
Yeah, so maybe that shows how I felt about the game. I'm thinking about other games that I like better.
All right. So, I mean, as word games go, I mean, where does this fall? I mean, think about things like Scrabble or...
way easier.
Way easier?
Yeah, you could definitely play with younger people.
Yeah, real easy to teach the rules.
And it's fun when you're in a war over that single letter.
Yeah, it did get more competitive and fun at the end, I think. Yeah.
Trying to go back and forth with the other team, give them the death glare.
Kind of the tug-of-war aspect. One thing that's interesting is that you can actually call out the wrong words to people. So no matter what the category was, we kept saying, car, dog.
Things that already had letters that were already taken if they wouldn't get
monkey.
Monkey. Monkey was a good one earlier.
We're still deciding whether a monkey is an animal with stripes or spots. All right, so...
And gummy bears are expensive.
And the gummy bears are expensive.
So you guys know our rating system, buy, try, or deny. What would you guys give Word on the Street?
I'd give it a try. It's not one that I would buy initially, but it would be fun to try.
Try, but Unspeakable Words is a buy. Totally.
Thank you, Single L. Jenny?
I would definitely try it, and now I want to play the other game.
Okay, we'll bring in Unspeakable Words next week, and we can give that one a shot.
That's a good game.
Karen?
Try.
Karen's about to fall asleep, so that's...
that's the best we can get out of her.
She had a cookie and chips, man. She's,
yeah.
All she needs is a glass of milk, and she's ready to go to bed. Sure.
All right, well, thanks for playing, and send it back to the studio.
Let's play some magic.
Oh, Single L. All right, so from the lunch table, got a whole lot of tries kind of around the table. That they seem to enjoy the game pretty
Your
much.
Your coworkers need to get off the fence.
I know.
Especially Single L.
But, you know, I they seem like they were a little tired that day. That I you know.
Science is exhausting.
We were sitting kind of in the sun that day. I don't know.
Oh, it's tough. It's so hard.
But, you know, I would definitely give this game a buy. I think it's a really great, quick game that you can play with anybody. I mean, you don't even... It's not even really a spelling game. So as long as you have one person who knows how to spell in your group, you know, because I think people could get kind of daunting, feel like that's kind of daunting of, you know, well, I don't know how to spell, so I don't want to do that. But it's really very accessible to just about anybody. Now, this is one of the very few games on... the lunch table that Cody has not had a chance to play yet. We just haven't gotten into the table. We've been playing a lot of other stuff. But we'll have to get you to check that one out. But does it sound like it might be interesting to you?
Oh, yeah. I like word games and out of the box. They don't make no crap.
No, they don't.
As they say. But, yeah, I definitely like to try it. So I love word games, and that seems right up my alley.
Yep, this one retails for $25, and I think it should be available definitely at Gen Con coming up, and it'll be available in your friendly professional gaming store pretty soon. So it's another edition of the lunch table. And
all right, and this is a pretty thick inbox, so to salute you intrepid souls who have made it this far, we have a contest for you.
Woohoo!
At Origins, we were able to pick up the new Wits and Wagers expansion pack.
Yeah.
And it looks very good. If you're a fan of the game, it's a definite buy. But you may not have to buy it if you can win our contest. What we're going to do is we're going to ask you a question in the Wits and Wagers style. So the answer will be a number. And the best way to enter, in fact, the only way to enter, is to email your response to the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
That's very nice. That's the one. So if you email your answer there, the one who is closest without going over.
We're going to go with the Price is Right rule.
Price is Right style, okay. Sure.
Closest without going over.
Sure. In Bob Barker's memory. Yeah, no, he's not dead.
I don't think he's dead.
No, soon. The question is, at Gen Con 2005.
2005.
Which was John and I's first Gen Con.
Our very first Gen Con.
We didn't know each other then.
No.
But that was our first Gen Con. Anyway, at Gen Con 2005, how many total events were there? So again, at Gen Con 2005, how many total events were at the con?
Right.
So email your guesses to the Game On Inbox at gameoninbox@gmail.com. And if you are the closest one, then you're going to get a nice copy of Wits and Wagers Expansion Pack number 1 shipped to you.
Now, I know that because it's gamers who listen to this show, and we're gamers too, that there's going to be a lot of questions about, well, how exactly do you know how many events there were at Gen Con? You know, we're going from a reliable source. We've got a guy. And so this is based upon the Gen Con events catalog.
We are in the gaming capital of the world, and we have connections as thus.
Right. We know a guy who knows a couple of guys.
Yep. So send those guesses, and you might win this cool expansion.
Yep. Well, that just about wraps up this, as you said, very thick Game On Inbox.
A husky.
Another husky inbox. But hey, that makes up for the fact that the Game On Inbox was about a minute and a half long last episode. So it's time to get into our big deal about game conventions entitled
Conversations.
That's nice.
Thank you.
The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big. All right, we've arrived at the big deal, which we're calling Conversations, and this is going to be, we're going to talk about just convention strategy, specifically about Gen Con, since we have the most experience with it, since it's here in our backyard. But you can apply it to any convention that you'd go to, we think.
Yeah, we think that as gamers, if you're listening to this show, if you're listening to gaming podcasts in general, you're of course going to hear about conventions because a lot of the podcasters go to these things, but we would really encourage you guys to check one out wherever you might live. If you're able to come to Gen Con, if what we are about to talk about is interesting to you, we would invite you to do it because we think it's a great idea for gamers to check out the con environment.
Almost a rite of passage, if you will.
I think so, yeah. And that's definitely how it was for me. My first Gen Con was in 2005, as we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And I just came on a Saturday because I'd heard from a friend of mine at work who had been coming to Gen Con for years. He was from Canada, and he used to drive down to Milwaukee from Ontario, where he was from, and would go there for years and years and years. And when it moved to Indy, and he also moved to Indy, he was totally excited that it was in the same town that he lived in. So he encouraged me to go check it out. And yeah, just after one Saturday of going through the exhibit hall, it was kind of got me hooked.
Okay, now we're going to talk, assuming you have never been to a convention before, especially Gen Con in this case. We'll use that as our example convention. And what kind of things are you going to want to prepare for if you're, say, a few months out from the convention, you're making your travel plans, you're booking your hotel? What kind of convention plans do you want to make?
Well, I would say if you're going to come to Gen Con, the very first thing you should think about is getting your badge. Mm-hmm. And badge registration for Gen Con opens up in February, mm-hmm. a different day every year, but it's sometime in February. If you go to Gen Con's website at gencon.com, they'll have, of course, have all that information there. But that's an important date if you don't live in Indianapolis. If you happen to live in Indy like we do, I don't normally get my badge on the first day that they go on sale. But a lot of people do because that is also the day that you're going to get your hotel code. Mm-hmm. All the surrounding hotels to the Indiana Convention Center are part of the Gen Con block of rooms. They set aside a certain amount of rooms in each hotel and give them a special rate. A lot of these hotels are really important because they have walkways that are connected to the convention center. This is real nice in middle of August in Indiana when it can be quite hot and, you know,
and sometimes rainy.
That's true, yeah.
If you don't want to get your new purchase of Descent wet in the rain, you know, that's a good idea to get a hamster tube.
Right, right. Yeah, as they're called, the hamster tubes. So you might want to get one of those hotels that's nearby like that. And so when you order your badge through Gen Con's website on the day that it, well, anytime actually after that, but it's a bit of a race on the first day to get those spots because the blocks of hotel rooms usually sell out on the first day. But when you get your badge, you'll actually get a hotel code, which you'll then enter into a website. I think is it called Passkey, I think?
I've never used it. I only get a hotel if Kaylin's family gets a hotel.
So. Right. I want to say it's called Passkey or something of that nature, but it's a system for, you know, mm-hmm. blocking off hotel rooms, that kind of thing. And you'll get that code, and then you can go and reserve your hotel room. And so there's usually a mad dash to get that on the first day. So you want to get your badge, and you also want to reserve some sort of hotel room.
Right. Now, the badge is important because if you get nothing else at Gen Con, the badge is pretty much your ticket of entry. This gets you into the dealer's hall, which we'll speak about in a minute. But if nothing else, you have to have this badge on you to even get to the next level of Gen Con stuff. And the next level, as it were, would be event tickets, which you can also get the day you get your badge, or you can get them later on when you look through the catalog and kind of pick which events you want to do.
Yeah, you know, I think actually the event registration doesn't start on that same day as badge registration. I think it's actually in May.
Okay.
When that happens, because they have to have a period of time where the game masters who want to run games will they'll submit their entries for the games, and this can be anybody. There's large companies that do game events at Gen Con, and it also could be, you know, I'm John and I have a copy of Descent and I want to run an event. You mm-hmm. can just submit that you're going to run a 4-hour event, and Gen Con will get you some space, a table and some room to play in, and we'll help you get it organized. So everybody submits those things, and then in May they have the beginning of event registration. This is also a bit of a scramble of a day mm-hmm. for the Gen Con faithful, because that's the day when things like True Dungeon tickets go mm-hmm. on sale. Those usually will sell out the very first day.
Yep.
And like Cody mentioned, yeah, once you have to have a badge to be able to get event tickets, and that's going to get you into those gaming events that you might be interested in.
Yeah, and these might just be 2 to 4 hour blocks where they're kind of large groups. One of them's called Game Base 7, where it's pretty much they just have a copy of the game laying there, and you have your ticket, and you sit there and play it for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Or you may get a little more love and appreciation. You know, a group may teach you the game, or like John said, it could just be a guy just not affiliated with any company whatsoever, just kind of running. Usually, you'll find them running on kind of RPGs. You know, maybe a scenario they made themselves or something of that nature. And if I can do a quick plug, there's a group that we really like that they're at Origins and Gen Con. Those are their two main ones. It's called Rogue Judges. And if there's any board or card game that you want to try that maybe you just you can't find anyone to play with at home, or you don't know anyone that owns it, these folks will not only teach you the game in a very good way, they've got a whole stable of expert game people. They will sit and play it with you. So this is especially good for bigger games like Descent or Arkham Horror that you may not be able to just get a quick demo of sometimes. And so we definitely recommend Rogue Judges. John will link to that in the show notes because that's what he does.
Absolutely. And yeah, it is a really great organization and a great group of people who kind of have the heart of teachers. Mm-hmm. And that means a lot to me as the person who in my group that tends to teach a lot of games. You know, it's great to be able to sit down and not know the rules of something and have someone who is good at teaching and who has kind of a heart for that and wants to do that. And all the folks that I've ever talked to at Rogue Judges, they want people to learn and to have a good time. And so you're not going to get a turned up nose from those folks of, oh, you don't know how to play this or you don't know this rule. They're there to help. So sure. Yeah, top notch organization.
And they also run the Vice Lords of Catizel game, which takes,
what is that?
It takes the Settlers of Catan. And instead of trading brick and grain and things like that, you're trading drugs and hookers and things like that.
Very
so,
nice.
So don't bring the kids to it, but I'm actually playing it for the first time. I've heard nothing but good and funny things about it. So I'll be sure to give a full report.
Not to go too long on Rogue Judges here, but don't they also do the Car Wars game?
Yes, they
What is what I've walked by it, mm-hmm. but I've never played it.
Car Wars was a game put out by Steve Jackson Game, I want to say in the early 80s. And they take it to the next level. They have this full, this probably almost like 10 foot by 10 foot, maybe even bigger than that, just like small city built. And you have these little matchbox cars and that correspond to the car you have. And, you know, it's got missiles on it and things of that nature. So you're...
on the car?
Well, not on the car itself, but I mean...
Like in the city, there's...
No. The city is what it is, and you move your car to represent kind of where your car is going, but...
Oh, but your car theoretically has,
yeah,
missiles and guns.
Guns
and stuff.
But
okay.
You can actually kind of see, like, okay, can I jump this overpass here and try to take out this school bus of death? and they actually have, you know, like mushroom clouds, and they have battle damage that they can put on the city. And it's remarkable. It's a four-hour event, but it's definitely something to check out. It's one of their signature events.
Oh, cool.
And as we're speaking of events, one other thing, John mentioned it, is a True Dungeon, and we did a podcast about True Realm a while back. But if you can get into this one, it's worth trying at least once at Gen Con. I mean, that's where it gets a start, and it's one of the more popular events. But if you're lucky, you can get in and get on the standby, and if maybe a group has an extra spot, you can get in there. The price is steep. It's usually about $40, which you have to get in generic tickets, which John will explain here in just a moment.
Yeah.
But it's definitely worth it. It's a signature event, and it's one of a kind, and it's kind of one of the features of Gen Con.
If you think about it in terms of, in your hometown, is there an organization that puts together a really, really awesome haunted house?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people would pay $30 or $40 to go in a really, really great haunted house. This is of that caliber as far as production values, probably better.
Yeah.
And it's an interactive experience. You know, if you want to learn more about True Dungeon, go check out actually episode 1 of our show where we go into a great amount of detail about that from last year's mm-hmm. Gen Con, or episode 17, which is all about True Realm. It's the same sort of deal. But yeah, that's definitely worth it. It does sell out almost every year on the very first day of event registration. So if you're hearing this and you're coming to Gen Con this year and you haven't gotten your ticket, you're not going to get one ahead of time.
Yeah.
But like Cody said, you might be able to find a group that is missing a person or someone who dropped out. And
I'm going
to
try it this year.
Oh, are you just going to try to get
it? Yeah, because I didn't get one this year.
Yeah,
so.
we weren't able to get tickets this year. But like Cody said, you can just show up with a certain amount of generic tickets. Now, when you do your event registration, and even when you go on site there, there'll be booths, you know, available with the event registration people the entire convention. And you can buy tickets for events. But you can also buy just generic tickets, and these are good for any event that has an open spot in it. So if you had a board game event that you wanted to play in, for example, and you just happen to be walking by and the event's about to start and they say, hey, you know, we've got a couple of extra spots here, you don't have to go all the way back to the event registration table, buy a ticket for that event, and then come back. If you have the right number of generic tickets, then you can just pay the guy that those, and then you can get right into the game.
And the going rate is roughly about one ticket per 2 hours of an event. Is that what it's been in the past?
I think that's right. And the tickets are like $2 or $3. So right. You're not talking about a huge amount of money here.
So it's always good, even if you don't have anything planned, it's always good to have at least a handful of generic tickets. So if you see something or look in the event catalog and something really catches your eye, you can go there with generics and see what your luck is.
Now, you mentioned the dealer hall or the exhibit hall. We both mentioned that. Give us a rundown of what are you going to find in the dealer hall.
The dealer hall is this. It is probably the biggest single area at Gen Con, and there you'll find exhibitors. You'll find kind of stores just selling their wares. You'll find even a lot of the times just these kind of detailed setups. I know Fantasy Flight puts together this huge area that's kind of half demo area and then half storefront. And they're pretty much anything gaming you could possibly think to buy, you can find it in the exhibitor hall or the dealer's hall at Gen Con.
Anything. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Cody's not being, not exaggerating here. I mean, really, anything from, some video game stuff. They have an electronic gaming area. Board games, card games, supplies,
foam swords,
medieval costumes, all kinds of things.
Anything
like that.
Gamer related, that's your place to go.
Yep. Also in the dealer hall at Gen Con, at least it's been in the dealer hall for the last few years, is there's an art show. And so there's a lot of artists who do fantasy and sci-fi artwork and gamer artwork. If you have a really cool Magic the Gathering card and you like the artist, it's very possible that artist might be at Gen Con displaying their stuffs, selling prints and things like that, and also, giving autographs. So that's a good place to go to if you want to take a break from all the game stuff and just go look at some pretty gamer artwork. Then you can check out the art show.
Yeah, and they'll even also sometimes have air quote celebrity guests there. Sometimes they brought folks in that were in the Star Wars movies or Battlestar Galactica or whatever, just kind of gamer friendly celebrities, and you can get autographs from them. Sometimes there's an extra fee. It really depends on the actor or celebrity or author.
Yeah, I think this year they decided not to have an official list of media guests, but you never know. There always might be a surprise.
Yeah, it's kind of a year to year thing, and some years are better than others.
Yep.
But this is, like I said, this is probably the biggest non-gaming event they have. I mean, they even have special badges where you can just go to the dealer's hall, and that's pretty much it. So this is definitely going to be a place you want to visit during your Gen Con stay, and we would recommend, at least I personally would recommend either Thursday or Sunday, because Saturday it's pretty much impassable, I think. It's almost just like a...
really crowded,
herding cattle through there, and if you go in Thursday, it's still pretty fresh, not everyone's arrived, and then Sunday, some people have left, and you can actually get some good deals on Sunday, because a lot of vendors may not necessarily want to take all their stuff back with them or don't want to pay for the shipping.
Right. The hours for the dealer hall are for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday are from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then on Sunday are from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's really where I spend probably half my time at Gen Con is in the dealer hall, just doing demos and talking to people, because you can just spend a ton of time. And we'd also mention that if you are interested in a board game especially, there are board game events, and so you might look through the Gen Con catalog and say, wow, this brand new board game that I've never played before, maybe I'll sign up for a 2-hour event. Well, that's fine, but you might actually be better off going into the dealer hall and trying to get a quick demo of that game before you commit to a full event for that. For one thing, the demo is going to be free, and the event will cost you a little bit of money. And also, you don't want to get into an event and just realize, I totally hate this game, but now you're kind of stuck playing with the people that have also paid their money. So the dealer hall is a great place just to check out new stuff. And of course, they take credit cards, they take cash, so they will be very happy to take any form of money that you have, and you can spend lots of money in there.
Exactly. Now, some of the other non-gaming events you could do at Gen Con and at many of the other larger cons, a lot of the conventions will have seminars. They'll have authors speaking, or they'll have prominent game designers, both in the board and RPG realm. In the board game, you might get question and answer type things, or what's on deck for a certain company. RPGs may have how to be a better game master, how to build quality dungeons, things of that nature. So there's a lot of seminars you can attend, and a lot of them sometimes are free. Yeah. So if you're an aspiring author, there are seminars for that. It's pretty much anything you could think of costuming. I'm doing a dancing seminar with Kalen this year. So.
And we can't help but also plug the fact that if you're interested in podcasting, there's a whole track of podcasting panels I'm actually going to be leading one on Sunday, strangely enough, Sunday afternoon.
There you go.
On studio equipment, things like that. So if you just want to come out and see some podcasters and do that, there's several of those to choose from as well.
And other rooms you might find, I know Gen Con especially has a whole anime area. Some conventions may just have an anime room, and a lot of these are 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in my younger and more vulnerable years when I watched anime, I would go to these things at cons, but I have learned the error of my ways. But if no, I'm joking. If you are an anime fan, you can definitely find what you're looking for there, and they pretty much have round-the-clock activities, so that'd be something to look out for.
One other thing, if you happen to have a spouse or a boyfriend or girlfriend that's not a gamer that you're, I guess, kind of dragging with you and
lovingly dragging,
they're nice enough to accompany you to the convention, and they're looking for something to do. There's a whole track of events at Gen Con called the Spa Events. SPA stands for something, but I can't ever remember what it is.
I don't either.
But it's these activities for gamer spouses or boyfriend girlfriends, and it's everything from jewelry making. They had one year on pole dancing.
John loved that class
for fitness.
Sure.
And lots of other things as well. I mean, I think there's
most of them are pretty tame. The pole dancing one.
Yeah, no, sorry, I kind of went extreme there. It's mostly things like crafts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of card making and stuff like that. So a lot of options there as well. So
and they're very good because. I've Kaylin's been to a few. I know I've talked to other people who've been a part of them, and they just rave about them. They say they're just spectacular, and that's almost like a mini vacation for them.
Yeah, and I think that the there's even things that aren't even at the convention center. I think there's a walking tour of Indianapolis.
Yeah, I know there's a wine tasting tour.
A wine tasting, okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So lots of fun there, and actually our good friend Marion McBride is the coordinator for the spa events there, so she's very
she does a great job.
She does a good job. Yeah. So,
and some kind of smaller and auxiliary things to do would be if you've ever played Are You a Werewolf or wanted to, you will find a game at Gen Con because
oh my gosh,
this is especially the later it gets, the more you wander the main convention center. You will find just pickup games of Are You a Werewolf.
A lot of them run by the Looney Labs folks. They have a whole. They usually commandeer an entire hallway,
pretty much
late at night to do those games.
Yeah, the later it gets, it's hard to spit without hitting three games of Are You a Werewolf. But
as much as you'll feel inclined to spit at the people who are playing it,
I like it. It's fun.
I played in one game of that, and I just. There's a whole culture of Are You a Werewolf people. The people that have played for. Years and years.
I've played with those people who kind of like, no, I've played this for years and years, and as a experienced member, it's like, shut up. It's freaking mob mentality. It's like, go away.
Settle down, Kasparov.
Yeah. Look at you. Very nice. Some other kind of quirky events you may want to check out. If you've ever played the game Kill Dr. Lucky, there usually is a life-size game of it where they pretty much, if you know the mansion from the game, they pretty much tape it off in this huge area of the floor, and you actually move around the area as pawns as you're trying to kill Dr. Lucky.
Oh, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
In the board game room, I actually found a game one year called The Incredible Edible Settlers of Catan.
Oh, yeah?
Where they actually made the entire board out of hexagon-shaped cookies with different colored frosting on them, and you would actually take, if you're building a road or something, I think they had some candy or something like that, and so you play the game, and then when you're done, you eat the game.
There you go.
So that's a fun one, too.
Yeah, and you may even look in your event catalog for Play With The Creator games. Now, I know Fantasy Flight does this. John and I played a Descent game with Kevin Wilson a few years ago, as we've talked about, and he destroyed us. But
but we were so happy about it.
It was fun. I mean, you know,
we loved being destroyed.
But you'll actually find a lot of games where it's like Play With The Creator or things of that nature. And it's really it's fun because if you got a rules question...
you know, that's going to be like, the person who can
it's
answer
like,
it.
You know, Kev, I've had this rules question. It's like, you know, no one's going to trump you. You know, yeah. You're playing it in your home game. And you're like, well, Kevin Wilson said you're wrong, so shut up.
Yeah, this year, actually, I'm signed up to play a game of Cosmic Encounter, the new version for Fantasy Flight with Kevin Wilson.
That'll be
so
fun.
We'll see how that goes.
And there's ton of other events and a lot of good things to do, but there's also some things we would say not to do. And I know John and I share one big one, and what would that be?
That would be don't fill your schedule too full, especially if it's your very first year. You are most definitely, if you've never been before, going to underestimate the amount of time it takes to do certain things, and also underestimate how tired you're going mm-hmm. to get. This is 4 days, best 4 days in gaming. It is so much fun, and you're going to want to go from 6 a.m. to midnight, you know, but you got to pace yourself.
Yep.
And, you know, my first year, the first year that I went for the entire 4 days, I was so excited. I signed up for all kinds of new stuff, which is a good thing to do if you're new to a convention. Sign up for lots of stuff you never tried before. But I signed up for 2 or 3 RPGs that I'd never played before, a couple of board game events, a miniatures painting class, a live action role playing game, which I'd never done before, all those things. And
back to back to back to back, wasn't it?
A lot of them were, yeah. So really, by on the very first day, I started at 8 o'clock in the morning with a role playing game event. Didn't even make it to the dealer hall until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Didn't have lunch until about 5,
oh, wow.
which I guess became dinner. But
right.
but it was, and I was just exhausted. I was having a great time, but by that just made the rest of the convention, you know, just kind of drug it down a little bit because I got too tired.
Yeah, and I know what you're thinking out there. You're thinking, well, I'm immune to this. You know, it's like I can go. No, you can't, because we both made this mistake. And it goes without saying, just relax, get those generic tickets, get maybe a few more than you might normally get, and go as your body dictates. You know, if you're still ready to go at 4 after just going gaming straight, you know, no break, then you can use your generics and keep going. But build those breaks in so you can use them if you need to.
And don't be afraid if you bought an event ticket to go and get a refund for it.
Yeah.
If it's an hour before the game and you're like, I don't think I'm going to make this, you can go to those event ticket counters and get refunds, I think, for like system credit in the system.
I think, can you exchange them for generic tickets?
Well, you probably, I don't know, you can either do that or you can turn them in, get system credit, and then buy generic tickets.
Yeah, so.
They'll definitely let you do that. But don't be afraid to blow a few things off if you don't feel like doing an event. Just the whole point is just to have a great time. And
definitely.
However you want to do that. All right. Well, I think that is a good, pretty comprehensive look of how Gen Con works. We're getting real excited about it. And we hope that if you're listening and you've never been, that you're excited about it too. It's a great time. And if you're not able to make it out this year, maybe make some vacation plans to come out to beautiful Indianapolis.
Beautiful enough, make a week out of it. There's a lot to do here, despite what some people might say.
Yeah, we didn't even mention that there's other ancillary gaming groups that do things on Tuesday and Wednesday before Gen Con. There's so much to do. So come in early. Have fun gaming and enjoy the convention.
Absolutely.
All right, well, I think that just about wraps it up for this big deal, and we're about ready to get into our buy, try, deny for the propaganda classic, Wealth of Nations.
In Soviet Russia, nation buys you.
Buy, try, or deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
Industry, science, and technology.
Big men putting screwdrivers into things, turning them, and adjusting them.
Build your own Atom storage box.
Bringing you state-of-the-art in soft-serve technology.
Snapple's caps off any size jug, bottle, or jar, and it really, really works.
All right, and on this episode's Buy, Try, Deny, we've got one of the Origins Award nominees for Best Game. It's Wealth of Nations from TableStar Games. And it's a, as the box says, it is a game of industrial production and international trade. So it sounds thrilling to me, but I can't give you quite the excitement that John would give you. John, tell us about Wealth of Nations.
Thank you, Captain Sarcasm. Wealth of Nations is designed by TableStar Games. It is for 3 to 6 players and takes about, I guess about 2 hours or so to play.
Sounds about right.
The box says it's for ages 13 and up.
No.
And well, maybe not, but I think that in order to play the game well, I think you probably need to be heading towards your teenage years there, because this is a purely economic game. It's a perfect information game, and it's a no-luck game whatsoever. So the outcome of the game is based solely on how well you play. So just to give you an idea of kind of how the game works, let me give you sort of the text from the overview here in the rule book. Wealth of Nations is the game of industrial production and international trade, as Cody said. You take on the role of a world economic power, developing and running industries to collect the commodities that they produce, sell these commodities on the market, trade them with other players, or invest them in the development of new industries. As your industries increase in efficiency, they produce more and more commodities. Selling commodities earns you much-needed cash, but watch out. If you sell too many, you'll collapse their market value, leaving you with industries too expensive to run. A wise player will have the right mix of expansion and diversification, and will always get a good bargain when trading with fellow players. The game ends when certain conditions are reached. At the end of the game, the players score victory points based on their cash reserves and how many industry tiles they have on the board. The winner is the player with the most victory points. In other words, the player with the most valuable combination of industry tiles and money wins. So like I said, this is a purely economic game where you're going to be getting resources that you're going to use to buy industries, that you're then going to buy commodities that will run those industries. Those industries will then produce commodities that you'll then turn around and use to buy more stuff. And you sort of create this economic engine during the game. And it's very elegantly designed, I think. So let me just go ahead and start off with some of the components that you're going to get. And this is, of course, a board game, so you're going to get a board. And it's in the shape of a rather large hexagon. And within the hexagon are a bunch of little hexagons. And all of your industry tiles are going to be hexagons as well. So I guess it sort of resembles maybe like a Settlers of Catan board, except it's a fixed board. And you're going to be laying these tiles onto the board during the game to build your blocks of industry. So there are six different kinds of industries in the game. There are farms, generators, academies, mines, factories, and banks. And they're all going to produce different resources. And all the resources are in the form of nice little wooden cubes. So a very sort of European, I guess, feel with the wooden cubes. And that's except for the banks are going to produce money, which the money in the game is in the wonderful Monopoly paper style money. So I guess you can take and replace that with poker chips or whatever other sort of form of money that you want. But the game does come with actual paper money. You're also going to get promissory notes. These are going to be little paper loans that you can take out during the game. And they're going to each be worth 20. Well, they'll be worth a different amount of money based upon how many that you have. So if you already are in some amount of debt, then the next promissory note you take, you're not going to get quite as much money for. So that's an interesting mechanic that the more debt that you have, the less you're able to borrow. You're going to get these tokens to represent automation. Automation will help you to increase the efficiency of your industry so that you don't have to use quite as many commodities to be able to run that industry. But those also cost some commodities in order to be able to purchase the automation. So that's something to consider. You're going to be playing a particular country in the game, and there's one of six sort of made-up countries. And I guess the flags for them, you know, you can sort of tell that one sort of represents England, one sort of represents, you know, France or whatever, but they all have different names. And you're going to get these flags that represent your country. And these flags you're going to use to claim spaces on the board that you can then build industry tiles on. So that's another important part of the game, is the fact that you're going to have to place these flags onto the board to claim the space before you're able to build an industry there. And it actually takes a labor cube to be able to place that. Now, if you don't have an industry that produces labor, then you're going to have to find some way to find that labor, which is probably either purchasing it directly from the markets or maybe trading or purchasing it from another player. So that brings me to the point of the markets, which are other boards that kind of go around the main hex board. Each industry has its own market, and it basically is a commodities market that shows you what the price of things are based upon the supply. Now, when I look at this, I really think of like an economics class in high school where you learn about the basics of supply and demand. This is really a great graphical representation of how that works, because you have all of these sort of recessed circular spaces that all these cubes will sit down in. And there's going to be a number underneath each circle that's going to tell you what the price of that particular cube is if you choose to buy it. And of course, you have to choose the one that's of the lowest price. And as you buy those cubes and they come off of the market board, the price gets higher and higher. So, you know, supply goes down, demand goes up, price goes up. So the price that you'll buy it at is right below the circle. If you want to sell a cube back into the market, then you're going to put that cube into the circle that's, you know, the next one that's available, and there'll be a price inside of the circle, and that's the amount that you're going to sell it for. And you'll notice that those numbers are usually a lot less. So you might buy it for $15, but then if you want to sell it back to the same space, you're only going to get $11 for it. So there's a whole bunch of these circles here, and these markets are for all six of the different resources in the game. And then on the board is a spot to put a stack of these industry tiles that you're going to also be purchasing during the game. So lots of purchasing, lots of buying, lots of selling, lots of trading. You're sort of getting the idea here. So let me just go over the basic setup of the game. It's pretty interesting, and this initial setup phase is the only, I guess I would say, luck factor in the game. Everything after this is going to be purely based upon your planning and your strategy in the game. But the way that you're going to start off is you're going to decide on a start player. They have an interesting little mechanism where you're going to take one of these, each one of the industry tiles, and kind of put them in your hand and have one of them shake out, and then that'll determine who's going to become the start player. And you're not going to start the game empty-handed. You're actually going to start by choosing, at the very beginning of the game, some things called starting packages. And so there are industry tile packages and commodities packages. And the game rules lay out very nicely what these different packages are. And some of them are like piles of food cubes or piles of energy cubes. And then, you know, there will be stacks of three or four farm tiles. It's this whole assortment of different kind of industries. And so at the very beginning of the game, you're going to have to sort of decide, what do you want to focus on? Because this game has a lot of paths to victory. Do you want to be someone who's in charge of all the food? I mean, do you want to kind of corner the market on farms so that you end up being a big food supplier for the whole game? Or do you want to be big on generators and generate a lot of energy that you'll then be able to sell and trade with other people? You can't really specialize in everything. There's just not enough time or resources to be able to sort of build your own giant mega world. You're going to have to rely on other people, but how you do that is really the interesting strategy in the game. So the initial choice of these different packages is sort of a fantasy football draft style, if you will. The very first player is going to pick one of the industry packages, pick whichever one that they want. And then once they select those, they're going to put their tiles onto the board wherever they would like to. And there's some rules as to how those can be placed. And then it'll go around to the left, and then the next player will choose another industry tile. And they'll go all the way around to that last player who's sitting to the, I guess, the right of the start player. And then that person will get to take two selections. So they'll get one industry selection, and then they're going to select either an industry or a commodities package, and then it'll snake back around. So if you're familiar with the fantasy football draft, it's sort of a snake draft. That's how it'll work. So the last person will select twice. It'll come back around to the first player, who will then select twice, and you'll keep going until all of the commodity and industry packages have been taken. So that'll sort of set you up with your initial conditions for the game, and then you're going to start your first turn. So each turn is divided into three phases: the trade phase, the develop phase, and the produce phase. And so you'll start off with the trade phase, and you'll start with that start player, and that person will get to do one action, and they have four choices. They can either buy a cube from the market, from any of the markets on the board. They can sell a cube to the market. They can barter, which is basically trading with any other player, go through some kind of a one transaction between another player, or they can buy a promissory note, basically get a loan from the bank. So they're going to do one of those four things, and then it's going to pass from the player to the left. They're going to get to do one of those four things, and it'll basically keep going around until all players pass. So, you know, this phase could take a long time. Actually, each of these phases could take a really long time depending on what all the players want to do. But those are the things you can do in the trade phase. So then it'll move on to the second phase, which is the develop phase. And here's where you're going to take those resources that you just bought, sold, and traded, and you're going to use those commodities to purchase things. So here's kind of how the purchase structure works. And there's a really, really nice player guide sheet that each person's going to get, a player aid. It's going to sit right in front of you. And it's very, very clearly spells out how much things cost. It's, I think, very well designed. And, you know, if you think of a game like Settlers of Catan where you're trying to build things, you know, it's got that card that has all of the different costs of everything on it. This works the same way, although it's quite a bit more complicated, but it's really easy to understand. So on your develop phase, you can do things such as place a flag. as I mentioned before, you have to put the flag of that country, of your country, into a hex before you're able to put an industry tile there. And that costs one labor cube to be able to do that. So you can do that, and then it'll move to the next player, and they'll get to do one thing. You know, like I said, it all kind of keeps going around. You get to do one thing until everybody passes. So you can place one of those flags. You can buy, buy and place an industry tile. Now, each of these industry tiles cost different amounts of stuff. So, for example, a farm, which is going to, you know, produce food, which is a yellow cube, is going to cost one capital cube, which is black, and one ore cube, which is white. So one black cube, one white cube, and you can take one of those farm tiles and add it to your block of industries. So there's costs for each of these industries. It's laid out really nicely on here. You're going to spend those cubes. And those cubes don't go back into the market like into those little circles. There's actually just a big supply, and that's where they'll go. So they're not going to go back into the market in that manner. So you'll purchase those things and place them on the board. You can also spend some cubes to do things like move industries around. I'm going to talk in just a second about how these industries are going to interact and produce things in the next phase. But you might have a reason to move industries around. You may want to force the placement of an industry tile because the industry tiles have to fit together. Each of the industry tiles has like a little sort of like half circles, and you have to fit them together in a way that they make complete circles when you butt them up against one another. If you were looking at these, you'd be really easy to tell. And they have to make complete circles of the same color. So you can't have like half of a yellow circle and half of a blue circle butted up against one another, because that wouldn't make the right colored circle. But if you want to force the placement of an industry that might not break those rules, you can do that if you pay one of those black cubes. Then you can also spend money to automate your industry. I mentioned they've got those automate tokens, and if you spend quite a bit of cubes for that, you can automate one of your industries. I'll explain in just a second what that does. So once everybody has gone around the table and has taken their turns and developed to their heart's content and then passed, then we'll move on to the third phase, the produce phase. And here's where you're going to take your different industries and you're going to produce commodities. You're going to feed commodities into them, and then they're going to produce for you. And the basic rule for how an industry is fed, or how it's fueled, is that you need one food cube for every tile that's connected. So if you have three, for example, academy tiles, these are the kind of tiles and industry tiles that will produce labor cubes. Let's say you have three of those that are hooked together. Then in order to run that block, that industry block, you would need three food cubes, one for each tile. And then you need one energy cube, it's a blue cube, to run the entire industry. So if you have one blue and then one food for each industry tile, then you'll be able to run that industry. The only exception is if you happen to have paid for that automation token, then instead of food cubes, all you need to run the industry is one energy and one ore cube. So that can be a good strategy for you if you don't really feel like making a lot of food, or if you happen to not really produce much food and don't feel like dealing with the jerk across the table who does have all the food, you can just try to automate everything. So once you've paid that cost to the supply there, then your industry is going to produce for you the kind of cube that that industry produces. So in the example I mentioned with the academies, you're going to produce these red labor cubes. The way that you determine how many of them you produce is you're going to look at the way that your tiles are fit together. And you're going to look and see how many completed red, in this case, circles your industry makes. So, you know, the way that you've butted those tiles up next to one another, you may have created several newly formed circles. So you're going to look at the number of completed circles that are in that industry, and that's going to be the number of, in this case, red cubes that the industry is going to produce. And so the pattern of these little half and whole circles on the industry tiles is different for every kind of tile. It's the same, like for every generator, they all look the same, but it's going to produce a different number based upon how you butt them up together. I think it's a really interesting concept in the way that they've done that. So then it's going to produce that many cubes, and that's what you're going to get as your production. So you'll do that with each of your industries, kind of going around the table until everybody has produced. You can't go around and produce from the same industry twice in one turn. And you also can't use the commodities that you just got from one industry and then feed another industry. You have to make sure that you have everything that you need for all of your industries before you run them in the produce phase. And so once the produce phase is done, that's going to be the end of the turn. You'll pass the start player token to the player on to the left, and you'll start a new turn. And so you'll start with a trade phase, which is phase one, then another develop phase, and another produce phase. And you'll just continue that on, lather, rinse, repeat until the game is over. The end condition for the game is whenever any player has placed all 18 of their flags on the board. They don't have to place industry tiles, just if all 18 of those flags are on the board. If every hex on the board contains either a flag or an industry tile, or if at least 5 out of the 6 different types of industry stacks have run out of tiles. So if any one of those 3 conditions met, that'll always occur in the second phase of the game, the develop phase, then you have one final produce phase at the end, and then you're actually going to go around and have one final trade phase at the very end. So you have like another phase one. And then once that's done, then the game is over. And so then you're going to add up your points, and here's how the scoring works. Players are going to earn 4 victory points for every industry tile that you have on the board, and a victory point for every $10 that you have. So any, you know, remainder of money that doesn't add up to a full $10 just doesn't count for any points at all. Now, if you have promissory notes that have not been repaid, those are worth -3 victory points at the end. So there's an incentive to pay off your debt because that's going to be minus points at the end. And then basically the player with the most victory points is the winner. If there's a tie, then ties are broken in favor of the player who has the most money. And any further ties are broken with the player who has the most flags on the board. And then I think they say, if all that is still tied, then you guys shake hands and say, congratulations, we both win. So that is a basic overview of Wealth of Nations. I know that it sounds like there's a lot to it, and there is. It actually is a very easy game to teach, but it is very difficult to master, I think, because of all that's going on and all of the different options you have when it comes to strategy. You know, we had a chance to play through a game of this with a 4-player game, and Cody, I'll go ahead and just ask you, what you thought of the game. I already know, I mentioned that this game has some similarities to Power Grid, and I know that's not one of your favorite games, so go ahead and let me know what you thought of Wealth of Nations.
This is not my kind of game, but I will tell you what jumped out at me. First off was just the art direction at it, and I know this is not related to gameplay at all, but...
No, it's an important part of it.
I think they really knocked it out of the park as far as just the art direction of this game. It's beautiful, the components kind of, they have that almost turn-of-the-century feel, it's like, capitalism and commerce, and,
It almost looks like, World War One, World War Two propaganda footage or something,
It's a beautiful game, and the components are top-notch, and... even though it's not really a game that I could get into, just playing it, I can really appreciate the mechanics of the game. This isn't a flawed game, and as far as economy-based games, this is actually probably one of the best. I think it just really it cooks along, and if you like that sort of game, then this is a good one.
Yeah, I feel the same way, and this is. This really is my kind of game. Mm-hmm. And so as we started playing it, and that first step where you're doing the fantasy football draft sort of thing to pick your starting packages, I could just sort of see it unfolding of, if you choose this one, now you're going to this track where you're going to be the main food producer in this game, or you're going to be the main capital producer, and you can really start to, leverage what you have to be able to control certain aspects of the market. That's one of the parts that stuck out to me is the fact that it's not just like I grab my stuff and I do my thing and you grab your stuff and do your thing. It almost has some similarities to Settlers of Catan in that if you set your settlements around the place where you're the only guy that's ever getting brick, then you're going to be the brick guy, and you'll be able to get good, good trades for your brick because you're the only guy making it. It's the same thing in this game, that if you can sort of corner a market on a particular commodity, then you all of a sudden become the main supplier for that commodity, and you have a lot of flexibility for how you're going to get the things that you need. So that aspect of the game, I think, is really interesting. It's a little dry, you know, compared to like Descent. I mean, you know, it's not a game like that. I mean, you have to be willing to sit down for a couple of hours and really be thinking. It's a decision game. It's a game about making really good decisions. But I think it is extremely well designed. I agree with Cody. The art direction, like art direction on a movie, the art in the game is very cool. It's sort of a Spartan, you know, industrial look to it, but it's really well done. And I love Perfect Information games. I like games where you don't have a hidden set of cards where you're going to play something and do the watcha on somebody at the last minute. So that's a good aspect for me. That's more my personality than anything else. But really enjoyed this one. I can't say really any bad things about it, except that it probably fits a particular niche of gamers. And like Cody said, he's not really that niche.
Nope.
But I think that if you are that kind of gamer that likes a pure economic game, I think that this one really would be a good one for you. So, Cody, Wealth of Nations, buy, try, or deny.
As I mentioned, this is not my kind of game.
This is not your game.
In spite of that, I will give this an emphatic buy.
Whoa.
I
wasn't expecting that.
If this even remotely is up your alley, I think this game's going to knock it out of the park for you. I can't think of any other economy-based game, Power Grid included. I mean, I hated that one too, but I think this one, like John said, there's the mechanics in it, it cooks, and you can just kind of see how things are going from the beginning, and I think it'll be a lot of fun, and especially if this is your cup of tea, then you'll just have a ball with it. So I give Wealth of Nations a buy. Now for you, John.
I'm shocked.
I'm reaching out.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you. Wealth of Nations. Buy, try, deny.
Oh, this is a total buy. This is like a buy plus.
No.
I think it's a really, really good game, and I was a little surprised by it. You know, Table Star Games, the games they made before were like all the hero card games.
Mm-hmm.
This is a completely different animal from
this
hero
is good.
Card. That's
what?
Not what I meant necessarily. But this is a completely different animal and really, really well done. So, I mean, if Table Star can continue to produce games like this, then I think they're really on their way. I think it's for a particular kind of gamer, but I think that if you are that kind of gamer, or if you're looking for an economic game, if you subscribe to the Jones Theory and you want to have one economic game, you should probably have Power Grid. But if you could have two economic games, I would get Wealth of Nations as well. So I give this one also an emphatic buy. So that's two big buys for Wealth of Nations.
Yep. A well-deserved Origins Award nominee.
All righty. Well, that just about wraps up episode 24 of Game On with Cody and John. We want to mention just a couple things to you before we go. One is that we are a proud member, as always, of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. So lots of great podcasts there. Be sure to check it out at pulpgamer.com. And we have our new website that's been up for a little while now at gameonpodcast.com, where we've got all of our episodes. We've got a little video where we explain the website to you. Be sure to check that out. And also, you can check out my review of Time Streams. Got probably some more game reviews coming up on the site there.
And don't forget our Twitter feed at Game On Podcast, all one word.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any news reviews or just want to chat us up or perhaps enter our contest that we talked about during the Game On Inbox, you can email us at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Well, join us in 2 weeks where we'll be getting geared up for Gen Con and have a lot of other great content for you and some game reviews and lots of other fun stuff to talk about. So until that fateful day,
Game On!